Daily News via remote. A U.S. judge in Washington said he plans to decide later on Sunday whether to block a Trump administration order banning Apple Inc. and Alphabet Inc.'s Google from offering TikTok for download. TikTok is that Chinese-owned video sharing app. U.S. District Judge Carl Nichols said after a 90-minute Sunday morning hearing that he plans to issue a public order before the end of the day. A lawyer for TikTok argued during the hearing the ban was unprecedented and irrational. Jordan's King Abdullah dissolved parliament on Sunday, officials said, which under constitutional rules means the government must resign within a week, paving the way for elections this fall. In July, Jordan's Electoral Commission set November 10th as the date for parliamentary elections after the monarch called for countrywide polls to be held at the end of the parliament's four-year term. Police in Belarus have detained at least 53 people so far across the country on Sunday amid protests against the outcome of last month's presidential election. This, according to a list published by a rights group. The arrest came as tens of thousands of protesters gathered in the capital Minsk for the seventh straight weekend, calling on veteran President Alexander Lukashenko to step down. And U.S. President Donald Trump demanded Sunday that his Democratic rival Joe Biden take a drug test either before or after the pair's first debate on Tuesday in his latest attack on his opponent's mental acuity. The president tweeted, "I will be strongly demanding a drug test of Sleepy Joe Biden prior to or after the debate on Tuesday night," end quote, or tweet. The president also tweeted that he thinks Biden's performances have been uneven, which he attributed to drugs. Mr. Trump tweeted he'd offer to take a drug test, too. Tuesday is the first of three presidential debates between the two candidates in the lead-up to the election. This is VOA News. Former Foreign Minister Mokhtar Ouane was named as Mali's interim prime minister, state television said on Sunday. This move will likely trigger the lifting of sanctions imposed by the West Africa regional bloc in the aftermath of the country's military coup last month. French President Emmanuel Macron on Sunday accused Lebanon's leaders of betraying their promises over the failure to form a government in the wake of the giant blast at the Beirut port in August. At a rare news conference devoted to Lebanon, Macron said the political elite were deciding to betray their obligations and had committed collective treason by failing to form a government. Lebanon's premier designate, Mustafa Adib, stepped down on Saturday, saying he had been unable to form a reform-minded government. The European Union called Sunday for a halt to fighting between Armenian and Azerbaijani separatists over the Nagorno-Karabakh region and an immediate return to negotiations. The worst clashes since 2016 broke out on Sunday between arch-foes Azerbaijan and Armenia, which have been locked for decades in a territorial dispute over the Armenia-backed breakaway region. A major conflict between the two countries could draw in top regional players Russia and Turkey. Putin has already called for a de-escalation, and so has Iran. The conflict over the enclave has been fueling regional tensions for 30 years. Ethnic Armenian separatists seized the region from Baku in a 1990s war that claimed 30,000 lives. Since then, the Azerbaijanis have sought to regain control of it. And Swiss voters appear to have accepted the introduction of paid paternity leave for the first time, allowing new fathers to take 2 weeks off after the birth of their child. This is what early projections showed on Sunday voting. A full 61% of Swiss voters were seen voting in favor of a two-week paternity leave in this wealthy Alpine country, long considered quite traditional in terms of family models and gender roles. And the solemn Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur, which annually sees Israeli life grind to a halt, is taking place in a nation already under a sweeping coronavirus lockdown. Every year, businesses shut down, roads empty out, and even radio and TV stations go silent as the faithful hold intensive prayers of atonement on the holiest day in the Jewish calendar. But this year, all non-essential businesses have already been forced to close, and Israelis must stay within 1,000 meters of their homes throughout the high holidays, which began last week. Yom Kippur begins at sundown on Sunday. Via remote, I'm Laurel Roman for VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
The era of giving intimidating judgments as if the judge is being compelled under gunpoint doesn't smell good for the judiciary. It's an unfortunate position.
Nigeria labor unions embark on a nationwide strike over electricity and fuel price increase Monday.
The Inter-American Court gives the powers of implementation to the Council of Ministers, which is a collegial body of ministers who will be able to determine the implementation. But when you give the member state, the singular member state against whom a decision is given, to implement it, it loses strength.
An ECOWAS court dismisses a petition challenging the announcement of sanctions on Mali.
From the get-go, ensuring the power is given back to the people where they can vote for their own local government people to decentralize government, and that will also help in, you know, disseminating development and also most likely cut back on the level of corruption.
And a Ghanaian opposition party endorses a female presidential candidate ahead of the upcoming December 7 general election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigeria Labour Congress has called on its members to embark on an indefinite strike beginning Monday. The call comes after the expiration of a two-week ultimatum to the government. The trade union is demanding that the government revert to the old electricity and fuel prices. Emmanuel Ogboaja, General Secretary of the Nigeria Labour Congress, says the ill-timed price increases has brought untold hardship to Nigerians and to private businesses. Meanwhile, the government has issued a directive preventing public sector workers from joining the strike on Monday. The directive also comes after an industrial court judge, Justice Ibrahim Galadima, issued a restraining order against the strike. But Emmanuel Ogboaja, General Secretary of the Nigeria Labour Congress, tells me that the strike will proceed as originally planned on Monday. He says that organizers of the strike are neither deterred by the court order nor by the government's directive preventing public sector workers from participation.
Yeah, it's born out of our failure to get the government on the negotiating table to do the needful. I appreciate the hardship that the twin policies of hiking PMS prices and hiking electricity tariff has brought on the people. This is a COVID period across the globe. Governments are seeking ways to cushion the pressure of the pandemic economically on their citizens, and ours is the reverse. We have a situation where this pressure is being brought to bear on an otherwise regular citizens that should be thinking of some relief. Instead of relief, what they are getting is heightened pressure economically. And we then try to get the government to understand that you cannot be talking about deregulation on an import-driven process.
Have you been able to engage with the government to address your concern so far?
Yes, the dialogue is on. We had a meeting late into the night on Thursday, and the government side sought an adjournment to go to see if they could improve on the mandate they had from the authorities or from the presidency. That was where we are at, and we're expecting them to reconvene the meeting. If it's done and they meet the basic minimum we have put across, then we can move from there.
Wouldn't Labour be discussing this issue in bad faith if indeed you are engaging the government to address your concern? Some people are suggesting that if the government fails to address your concern, then you can embark on the strike. But embarking on the strike while negotiations are still going on is in bad faith. What do you say to that?
No, you must check the history. Why did we get here? This was a process that they failed to consult. This was a process they failed to get across to us in spite of repeated and numerous letters and moves made to get to them to get to the negotiating table. It took our giving an ultimatum for the negotiations to commence. Clearly, for us, it's not about dialogue with the deaf or dialogue as a means of hamstringing and tying our arms. We want to see sincerity in the discussions. If the sincerity is a matter, we can dispose of in a two-meeting setup. It doesn't have to run over a long period of time.
The government has issued a directive calling on all public servants not to participate in this organized labor strike beginning on Monday. Isn't this going to take a sting out of what you are trying to do?
That should be where you should be asking, is that not in bad faith? The government does not control the trade unions. A directive from a government cannot rescind that decision. It cannot take no sting out of our decision. Ironically, outside the regular working people, their families are enraged. Entrepreneurs are enraged. There is nobody that is not feeling terrible about the pressure being caused by the electricity challenge, where you are made to pay for what you don't consume. They are not metered. There is no certainty as to what people are being charged. So it will take more than a mere notice from a head of service to derail the determination of the people.
I understand Justice Ibrahim Galadima has issued a fresh restraining order against the unions following an ex parte application by the Office of the Attorney General. Are you aware of this, and what are you going to do about it?
We're not aware, but the history of struggles in Nigeria is replete with characters like Justice Galadima, who seek to compound the problem of society by their ill-informed interventions through the judiciary. Our indication, our notice was clear. He had 14 days running. If the judge was fair and was acting judiciously, he should have thought that we'd be put on notice. We were not put on notice. You must hear the other side. The era of giving intimidating judgments as if the judge is being compelled under gunpoint doesn't smell good for the judiciary. It's an unfortunate position.
Does that mean that all is set for the strike to begin on Monday?
There's no going back except we have a clear understanding with the federal government.
Emmanuel Ogboaja is the General Secretary of the Nigeria Labour Congress. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. A court of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has dismissed a petition challenging sanctions imposed on Mali. Two Malian groups petitioned the court challenging the ECOWAS president's imposition of sanctions on the country. They were introduced following the overthrow of former President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. The Malian groups argue that the president of ECOWAS does not have the legal backing to announce the imposition of the sanctions, which they said has brought untold economic hardships on citizens. They also contend that the sanctions are a violation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This, despite the imposition of sanctions by ECOWAS regional leaders, they issued a statement in support of the same sanctions as those announced by the president of the commission. To learn more about the ruling, I reached Justice Dupe Atoki, who presided over the ruling at the ECOWAS court.
As you very well know, the matter was dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. The powers of the court is derived from jurisdiction, which is conferred on it by its enabling laws. And in this case, the ECOWAS Treaty, the various supplementary acts and the protocols, a court cannot act outside its jurisdiction. Apart from its well-known powers now to determine violations of human rights in member states by member states, the jurisdiction of the court extends to adjudication in disputes in relation to the interpretation and implementation of an act, a regulation, a directive, a decision, a recommendation, and opinion. The statement of the president of the commission is such that the court is unable to situate it into any of the above legal regimes. It's not a directive because it can be issued by the president of the commission. These directives are issued by the Council of Ministers. though the powers to impose sanctions is conferred on the authority of heads of state, the statement of the president of the commission imposing sanctions, since it cannot be situated under any of the regimes earlier articulated, the court is devoid of any powers to entertain a complaint on the statement.
Justice Atoki, I spoke with some Malians and they say that they don't understand why the court didn't find the argument that the two Malian associations presented in court persuasive enough for consideration. How do you respond to that?
The argument that they have canvassed before the court does not support the jurisdiction of the court. Yes, a statement was issued by the president of the commission wherein it imposed sanctions. Before we proceed to analyze that statement to determine whether the president of the commission has powers to issue that sanction or not, we must first determine whether we have jurisdiction to entertain that matter in its entirety. They have jumped a level of not looking at the jurisdiction of the court and wanting the court to immediately analyze the legality or otherwise of the statement of the president. That we cannot do. First, we must determine that we have jurisdiction. Then we can go into merit. Was the president of the commission entitled to issue a statement imposing sanction when the treaty confers that powers to the authority of heads of state? That we can then decide.
Does that mean that because of the issues of jurisdiction, the court will not deliberate on the legality of their statement and therefore dismiss all their claims in the application?
Absolutely. Because if you deliberate, then you have acted ultra vires because you don't have the power to deliberate on a statement issued by the president of the commission. It's not one of those acts or one of those regimes that the protocol establishing the court has articulated.
What is the message here to those who would want to bring issues such as this to court the next time?
The lawyers should read the text. Lawyers should study the jurisdiction of the court and don't come with emotions, which is very germane and which is understandable for members of for the Malians. But a court will only act in line with its jurisdiction. And if it doesn't, no matter how germane that is, no matter how credible and relevant the concerns are, the court cannot close itself with the jurisdiction that it has.
Some people have expressed concern that there's need to strengthen the enforcement of the ruling of the court when the ruling goes against member countries in the region. What is your take on that?
I agree totally. I agree because the members of the court are not satisfied with the level of implementation of its decision. And the court is working on certain proposals and modalities that will enable the member states to be compelled to implement the decision. One of such is the flawed mandate given to member states to implement the decision themselves, which is completely outside international practice. Both the African Court, the African Commission, the European Court, the Inter-Americas Court give the powers of implementation to the Council of Ministers, which is a collegial body of ministers who will be able to determine the implementation. But when you give the member state, the singular member state against whom a decision is given, to implement it, it loses strength.
Justice Dupe Atoki presided over the ruling at the ECOWAS Court. She spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Ghana's opposition Progressive People's Party, or PPP, has endorsed Bridget Jogbenuku as its presidential candidate for the upcoming December 7 general election. Ms. Jogbenuku was the vice presidential candidate for the party in the 2016 polls. The party's endorsement makes her the second female presidential candidate to contest in the elections. She is an entrepreneur, a former business executive, and a career coach. She also says Ghanaians are poised to reject candidates from the two major parties, incumbent President Nana Akufo-Addo and former President John Dramani Mahama. Ms. Jogbenuku tells me that she plans to implement measures to strengthen the structures of the government to ensure good governance that will improve the living conditions of every citizen.
We have
a big overarching vision for Ghana. We want to take Ghana back to the days where, and it's a vision looking forward, but we want to take Ghana back to the days where, you know, there was a lot of discipline and there was justice. A disciplined society where everything worked, where government institutions worked well, where education was at its peak. Certainly, it's a start. We don't think about, we can work towards eradicating poverty, but we actually want to raise the social life of the Ghanaian to a point where they have jobs and they can afford a healthy living, and their quality of health care is available and it's at a standard where everybody can afford to access it.
Ms. Jogwenuku, what makes you uniquely qualified to become Ghana's next president?
I am a Ghanaian woman, obviously. I have lived my entire life in Ghana. I was brought up as a child in the military barracks. I also did my university education in Ghana, except for 1 year, which I did in Tanzania, so because I studied Swahili. In saying so as well, I have, since 2008, undergone several leadership programs, some sponsored by the U.S. State Department, or actually participated as a Vital Voices Fellow. Vital Voices is an NGO that invests in the life of women in countries across the world and trains them into leadership. So I have been undergoing these leadership programs year after year until now. Now, when I bring it home, I worked here. I've worked all my life in Ghana. I myself run a business in a community where women produce edible palm oil, and I am the marketer, I am the buyer from them. So I know their life, I know how their well-being feeds into the life of their children and their children's health and their children's education. So I have been down with the communities and worked for them and worked with them.
Why should Ghanaians trust you?
Being a woman and having lived the life of Ghanaians, knowing what they want, knowing what they lack, having this vision of making it better for all of us, they must trust that I am bringing something different from the other two, the duopoly we've had for forever. To say, listen, we have tried the two and we haven't advanced much. We are saying that our PPP, and including myself as a leader, are an incorruptible government coming up to do things differently. We are compassionate. We care about the people and their well-being. It is not about us. It's about them. They themselves want something different. And this is the time to put that trust in us to say, listen, they are different. They haven't done it before, but we believe that it's time to try a woman-led party and have the belief that they want the best for Ghana and take them on.
If the Ghanaians give you the trust to vote for you in the December polls, within the first 100 days or perhaps the first year, what do you think are the pressing needs of the people that needs to be addressed immediately before the first year is over?
We keep saying that our constitution needs review. We actually reviewed the constitution some 6 or 8 years ago, and it was put away. It hasn't been looked at. The fundamentals of our democracy need to be addressed, and those are the things that we need to address from the get-go. We believe that our local government officials should be voted in, you know, as independent of any party, to ensure that they are held accountable by the people and are not beholden only to the president or to their political party in power. So that is one thing we're going to address from the get-go, ensuring that power is given back to the people where they can vote for their own local government people, to decentralize government, and that will also help in, you know, disseminating development and also most likely cut back on the level of corruption.
Bridget Jogbenuku is the presidential candidate for the Ghanaian Opposition Progressive People's Party, or PPP. She spoke with me from the capital, Accra. Meanwhile, Ghana's opposition party, the All People's Congress, or APC, says it is displeased with a response from the country's Electoral Commission regarding what the party says are exorbitant nomination fees for presidential candidates. The opposition party accused officials of the commission of failing to consult political parties before announcing the fees. The commission says all presidential candidates must pay about $18,000 to participate in the upcoming December 7 presidential poll. But critics say the fee is unreasonable, arguing that 4 years ago, candidates paid about half as much as they do today. Meanwhile, in response to the APC's petition, the Electoral Commission says the nomination fee will be returned to candidates that attain at least 25% of the total vote cast in the presidential poll. But Francis Ansateria, a spokesperson for the opposition APC party, tells me that the commission's response is unacceptable.
The All People's Congress petitioned the Electoral Commission of Ghana with regard to the filing fee about the EC increase from 50,000 Ghana cedis to 100,000 Ghana cedis. In 2016, the filing fee for the president, that was 50,000 Ghana cedis, and the parliamentary was 10,000 Ghana. They maintained the 10,000 for the peace without the parliamentary, but for the presidential, the increase is from 50,000 to 100,000 Ghana cedis. So we in APC believe that for COVID, they should have considered the political party, because COVID has affected a lot of businesses in this country. So we are expecting the EC to either maintain the 50,000 and not 100,000 Ghana cedis. That is why we petition the EC.
Francis, is the APC satisfied with the response you got following your petition to them?
Well, we are not satisfied with the response from the EC in the sense that because of COVID, and the response from the EC, they concentrated much on what the parliamentary, that the parliamentary fee, in the sense that it was 10,000 they maintained. So they were the view that we can still file out 275 pieces, but with the presidential, because of the number, they increased from 50,000 to 100,000 just to reduce the number, because in 2016, they had to devise a different route of cutting down the number. That is why some of the parties went to Supreme Court to what they codified with the decision of the EC. So now the only option they had was to increase it from 50,000 to 100,000. That is why they increase it. But they maintain it just for other political parties to be able to fight their parliamentary candidate and increase the presidential, so that at least they will get only the serious political parties to fight for their presidential seat.
But the Electoral Commission is of the view that if your party, a serious party, as you say, is able to garner about 25% of the total vote cast in the upcoming December 7 election, the money for the nomination fees will be returned to you. Why is the APC the only party expressing concern about this?
Well, the issue is that the APC is not the only political party that is concerned about that. With the exception of NPP and NDC, all the other political parties have raised issues. All of them are complaining. There that we are the only political parties that officially is petitioning the EC. And I can confidently confirm to you that if the EC maintains the 100,000 Ghana cedis for the presidential, it will be difficult for many of the political parties to fight their presidential candidate. It will be difficult, especially with the independent presidential candidates. It will be difficult for them to pay that amount of money.
Some people are suggesting that if the party is complaining about it, that means the party is sure it will not gather the 25% threshold the Electoral Commission has put in place, which means that if you can't get 25% of the vote, then you should not contest in the presidential election. Why do you think that is discriminatory?
The issue is that in the past, the EC used to engage the political parties before they even come out with the filing fee for both parliamentary and presidential. But this time around, they didn't engage the political parties. If they had engaged us, it would have been a different thing. I think we would have raised that issue, and we would have probably suggested a different amount instead of giving 100,000. At that 3 days ago, most of the political parties raised the issue of the filing fee. The worst thing is that we didn't even discuss it. the EC seems not to be interested in that discussion about the file which is contribute to get that amount of money.
So, Francis, what will your party do in this instance?
Well, we raised it at IPA 3 days ago, but we didn't discuss it at IPA because the EC were interested in different issues because their concentration was on the exhibition that the voters did, exhibition that is currently going on. So, at the moment, the EC is not interested in discussing the filing fee. We will pay the 100,000 Ghana cedis. We will as well pay for our PC to contest. But what we are saying is that next time, if the EC want to increase the filing fee for both presidential and parliamentary, they need to engage the political parties because the political parties are the major stakeholders. So they need to engage ourselves.
Francis Ansateria is a spokesperson for Ghana's opposition party, the All People's Congress, or APC. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half, Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impoga and music from our African collection. But first, in Uganda, the Opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP, is choosing candidate to represent the party in parliamentary and local level elections ahead of next year's polls. The NUP also says it is in talks with other opposition parties to develop common strategies for defeating incumbent President Yoweri Museveni and his governing party, the National Resistance Movement, or NRM. Analysts say the lack of unity among the opposition remains the biggest obstacle in the quest to defeat the president in the next election. This, despite what they say, appears to be the popularity of parliamentarian Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine, the presidential candidate of the NUP. Parliamentarian Mathias Mpuuga is a deputy president of the Ugandan Opposition National Unity Platform, NUP. He tells me that the party is attracting a lot of candidates to run in next year's general election due to what he says are the attractive electoral prospects of Bobi Wine.
Well, the process is ongoing, as you might imagine, and I can state from the onset that it's a tedious process because apparently, the NUP being the major or the most active opposition political party in this political season, there's a lot of interest across the country for individuals to run on the NUP ticket. So it's a very tedious process for party structures to select candidates at different levels because of the enthusiasm and the time is very short. Remember, NUP has just been official formed, just about 2 months and a few weeks. So having a structure that is capable of undertaking a rigorous process of selecting candidates is no mean feat. Nonetheless, we have risen up to the occasion, and so far, so good.
Mathias, some people are saying that despite the popularity of your presidential candidate, Robert Kyagulanyi, otherwise known as Bobi Wine, the party doesn't have structures across the country that makes it competitive in next year's elections. How do you respond to such assessment?
I must state from the onset that that's only partly true because, you know, the way our politics is structured is such that you must be able to reach every bridge in the country, every sub-county, every parish. That doesn't come in 1 week. Over the last couple of months, we've been working at buttressing the party at various levels. Of course, with a lot of animosity from the regime, using security to make sure that we do not reach the grassroots. But we're doing our best. The presidential candidate is very popular. That is very true, which is why we have so many people wishing to run on the ticket. One of the things that are difficult to do is that it's very difficult to build a party in an electoral season. Party building and establishing formidable structures, whereas building a party takes time, and we are not oblivious of this fact. So we're trying to undertake a very difficult process of building the party at the same time preparing for a very difficult election in a dictatorial and democratic environment. So we're not oblivious, but we're doing our best to get out victorious.
Talking about working with other political parties to ensure your interest is protected, some are suggesting that why don't you team up with other opposition parties so you support each other in places where they are strong you support their candidates. Areas where you are strong, they support your candidate because of the dominance of the ruling National Resistance Movement Party or NRM Party of President Museveni. What do you say to that?
We like the fact that we are time back, and I can tell you at another level, away from the limelight, we are working the phones and meeting with Bill Seat regularly to appraise ourselves on these possibilities. And I'm sure as night falls day, we should be able to make breakthrough as to this possibility. It's not easy, I must confess, not easy, but there's goodwill, there's immense goodwill from a number of political players to work with us, and we want to take advantage of that possibility. We know that we can go a place if we are able to sacrifice some of the areas, and we do not really encourage him with the presence and support those political groups that have had a presence in those areas and therefore are able to master support and be able to realize a victory in those areas. So we are like to wait and active. We believe in the next few weeks we should be able to pull off that kind of arrangement.
Political analysts in Uganda are of the opinion that the front of the opposition parties are too divided. So the significant challenge that you want to pose to President Museveni might not be a stiff challenge, and that your divisions could pave way for him to win re-election. What do you say to that?
The divisions in the party are partly sponsored by the ruling party, the junta in Kampala, and we are alive to those squabbles. Some of the squabbles and the people who vote us are not involved. And we're trying to minimize these squabbles by dealing with those groups that are honest. We know for a fact that some of the opposition parties have been captured by the regime, and therefore they would do what it takes to make sure that unity is impossible. We also like that fact, but we're not sleeping. We're not lying to let that go. We are trying as much as possible to make it a game, an association, an undertaking of the willing. And we know that there are so many groups that are very willing to work with us. They are honest groups. The FDC people, we are talking. And the other groups, including individuals that do not want to associate with the regime, even when their parties seem to be soft on the regime.
Parliamentarian Mathias Mpuuga is a deputy president of the Ugandan Opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. September 26th is World Contraception Day, set aside by the UN to emphasize the importance of sexual and reproductive health and family planning, and to support providers of that care for women and girls everywhere. This year, the challenges to universal access to contraception and family planning are far greater than usual due to COVID-19. Viewers Adam Phillips spoke with Susan Papp, Managing Director of Policy and Advocacy at Women Deliver, a global NGO dedicated to the health and well-being of women and girls. Ms. Pa began the interview by bluntly stating a simple truth.
Just because COVID has happened, people don't stop having sex and they don't stop having babies. But what we are finding is that there's been a disruption in access to sexual and reproductive health and rights services. And this disruption maps very well to what kind of disruption we saw in Africa with Ebola several years ago.
How so?
Supply chains are compromised. Services like access to contraception, wellness visits around family planning, access to safe abortion. And in some places where you have particularly strained health systems in Africa, sexual and reproductive health and rights services fall off because these systems are so strained.
Because of COVID?
Yes.
So what's the upshot of that? How does this falling off affect women?
So the Guttmacher Institute is a think tank. They, along with some UN agencies, have conducted a number of estimates on what it means when sexual and reproductive health and rights services are disrupted. As a result of these disruptions, 50 million more women have an unmet need for contraception. 16 million women are going to have unintended pregnancies. 200 million will experience major obstetric complications, and 1,000 additional maternal deaths are estimated to happen as a result of disruptions in services around reproductive and sexual health. So it's really alarming the downstream effects of COVID, particularly to girls and women.
What is the remedy you suggest to right this balance?
I would say the UN systems and the governments need to recognize that sexual and reproductive health and rights are an essential part of services, that it's a non-negotiable. The UN General Assembly had several political statements that are going before all of the member states. One is an omnibus statement on COVID, and that omnibus statement rightly understands the gender dimensions of COVID. And so that's a positive sign. The World Health Organization also recognized the gender dimensions of COVID. The UN Secretary General has put out a COVID response and recovery plan that has gender dimensions included. But I think what we really need to ensure is that those aren't just words on a page, that it leads to action. And that action comes down to country leaders recognizing the normative guidance from the UN and following through on it.
Suzanne Papp is the Managing Director of Policy and Advocacy at Women Deliver. She spoke with viewers Adam Phillips from New York. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Kenya's Helen Obiri and Faith Chipigion registered 2020 world best times over 3,000 and 800 meters respectively at Friday's final Diamond League meeting of the season in Doha. Obiri, back in the city where she won the world 5,000 meters title last year, dominated the concluding women's 3,000 meters race before winning in 8 minutes 22.54 seconds. While Kipigion, the Rio 2016 1500 meters champion, clocked 1 minute 57.68 seconds. The final action of the evening saw Armand Duplantis of Sweden maintain his unbeaten run in a season that has brought him a pole vault world record of 6.18 meters and the world's best outdoor vault of 6.15 meters. Obiri was briefly headed by compatriot Beatrice Chepkoech, the world champion and record holder in the 3,000 meters steeplechase, only to reassert herself at the start of the back straight before striding clear. All five women behind Obiri claimed the personal bests. A late run gave Kenya's world 10,000 meters bronze medalist Agnes Tirop second place in 8 minutes 22.92 seconds, with Chepkoech third in 8 minutes 22.92 seconds, and two other Kenyans followed her home. World 5,000 meters silver medalist Margaret Chelimo Chipkemboi in 8 minutes 24.7 seconds, and 2015 world 3,000 meters steeplechase champion Hyvin Kiyeng on 8 minutes 25.13. Ethiopia's world 1,500 meters bronze medalist Goodof Segai was sixth, with Britain's Laura Waitman seventh in a season's best of 8 minutes 26.31 seconds. The men's 800 meters race was won by Kenya's Ferguson Cheruiyot-Rotich. The world bronze medalist crossed the line in a season's best of 1 minute 44.16 seconds, recording his fifth consecutive win. Britain's Elliot Giles was second in a personal best of 1 minute 44.56 seconds. And in football, the 128th Casablanca derby between arch rivals Wydad and Raja ended in a goalless draw on Thursday at the Mohammed V Stadium. The match took place behind closed doors. Raja started the game leading the pack with 48 points, one more than rivals Wydad, with just 5 games remaining. Now Raja leads the table with 49 points, one more than Wydad in second place. RS Bakene, who defeated FAR 2-1, is third with 47 points. And former Cameroon defender Ephraim Mbom died last week in Douala after a long illness. He was 66 years old. Mbom was a member of the Indomitable Lions squad that played in the 1982 Africa Cup of Nations in Libya, and later the same year he was part of the Cameroon squad that played its FIFA World Cup debut in Spain. He spent his entire career at home, most notably with Caron Yaounde, winning 5 Cameroon League titles in 1979, 1980, 1982, 1985, and 1986, and 3 Cameroon Cups in 1978, 1983, and 1986. Mbom retired in 1990. He held various positions in Cameroonian sports afterwards until his death. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Don't be like a novice, but a ranking director, don't you know this? Don't you know?
Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Reporter Douglas Mpuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the elephant never abandons its task on the road, no matter how heavy they may be. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.